For the week of September 20th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 295, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And outside Univision headquarters, I'm Michael Gills.
Why are you outside Univision headquarters?
Goodbye, Sabato Gigante.
Yeah, I saw that actually after what, like 53 years this show was on the air?
117 years. Goodbye, Don Francisco. It's an institution shown around the world. A big farewell. It was as silly and sentimental as always.
Well, and I heard Donald Trump, who is now running for president, was very, very upset. He basically pointed to Don Francisco as a thief. Gigante in Spanish is huge. That's what it means. And everybody knows when you talk about huge, you're talking about Donald Trump. I need a cricket thing, a cricket sound effect.
You need to not make stand-up humor.
Oh, come on. Actually, Sarah J., one of our listeners, sent us an email. It took me a week to
figure... I already don't like Sarah J. I don't know what she wrote to you, but I'm not a fan of Sarah J.
Thank you very much. Michael is already... you are already...
Keep going. What did she say?
Well, she said, I can't believe that you missed the big joke about Arnold Schwarzenegger taking over Celebrity Apprentice. And it took me a week to figure out, what is she talking about? What joke did we miss? And then I realized it's the tagline of when they fire somebody. It's, I'll be back next week, but you won't. You're terminated. I think that's what she was referring to.
Well, she's encouraging you to do more humor. So God bless her for that.
Well, if there's any way to turn off our listeners at the front of a show, congratulations, we've just done it. Well, done it. Yes. I will take full responsibility.
If Sarah is still listening, what will she hear about on this week's show?
On this week's show, we're going to be joined by Ann Thompson, actually, IndieWire's editor-at-large, who is just now returning from her usual whirlwind of fall film festivals, including Telluride and Toronto. She'll give us a feel for what both festivals were like this year, which films created the most awards buzz, and which she thinks audiences should be looking forward to. And maybe Anne will be able to stick around for our discussion about last night's Emmy Awards, also known, by the way, as HBO's Victory Lap. There were a number of firsts last night at the Emmys, especially in the actor and actress category, and we'll fill you in on some of the night's big winners. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilts to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world, and we have notes from Rentrack, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, you name it. And the number one movie is Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials. It made $73 million over the weekend. It already opened up overseas, so it has now made $108 million worldwide. It was the number one movie in North America, handily beating Johnny Depp's comeback film, Black Mass. And it's a big success story. Everywhere it's opened, it's been number one, practically everywhere, I think, if not literally everywhere. And it's tracking well ahead of the first movie. So they're very happy. The budget was doubled. It cost about $61 million for this movie, as opposed to a rock bottom $35 million for the first one. And everybody's happy.
Some people might call it Gigante.
And number two around the world is Black Mass, Johnny Depp's comeback film. I say comeback because he's made a lot of bad movies and, more recently, bad movies that aren't making money. Now, Black Mass opened to $23 million. That's his best opening in a while, and that's for a heavy-duty drama. This is not exactly a bring-the-kids Alice in Wonderland opening weekend-type movie. This is a movie that should appeal more to adults. It got good reviews. People will presumably be showing up second and third weekend, so it should have good legs. But it's his best commercial start and certainly his best reviews in a long, long time.
Yeah, no, I mean, people are saying that it's, certainly some of the headlines I read about this were that he's so good in this role, it should be illegal. And I guess that's a pun on the fact that he plays basically a mobster.
Not basically. He is a mobster. Whitey Bulger. Yeah. He's a mobster.
All right.
At number three around the world is Everest. This is the Jake Gyllenhaal film. It grossed $21 million over the weekend. It's at $23 million and counting. It opened up mostly on IMAX screens.
What? Mostly on IMAX screens?
Didn't it? Yeah, completely? Mostly?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's on 545 screens. It was premium large format and IMAX. That was the opening weekend gambit of this movie. That is, it's on premium large format screens where it made $13,000 per screen. And their idea is that they're going to, this is in North America where it grossed $7 million. It's on 545 screens here. And the idea is to build up word of mouth, get people to see this event film. They're going to do the same thing with The Wire in a week or two. That's the, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt film.
Not The Wire. The Wire is the documentary. Oh, this is The Walk. Because,
The Walk. I beg your pardon. The Wire is also an HBO show.
Okay. No, so, Man on Wire was the documentary about...
The Wire is the HBO show by David Simon. And The Walk is the 3D IMAX film from Robert Zemeckis starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It, just like Everest this week, will open on smaller screens, 545 in the case of Everest. There'll be premium large format screens, often IMAX, to tout the movie's big spectacle. This is an event. And the idea is, hey, you know, you got to break through the clutter. You got to break through the noise. And if you think your movie is good and you don't need to cash in as quickly as possible, if you think people will see it and tell other people, you got to go see this movie, then you can take the risk, I guess, if it's considered a risk, of opening up on, you know, a more modest release pattern. Right? Everest is number 5 for the week, but it's considered a success story. It's got the highest per screen average of any movie in the top 12, probably in the, you know, probably in the whole list, perhaps, in North America. It got good reviews. People like it. It's a spectacle. So they're hoping when they go wide next week or the week after, that all that word of mouth will be for the positive. At number 4 is a movie that did this gambit last time. It's Mission Impossible. Their last movie in the franchise opened up on IMAX screens and had a week of, you know, not being the number one movie, but getting lots of good press and attention.
This is Mission Impossible 4 that did that.
That's right. Yeah. The last one of this movie did that. Now the new one, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, is proving to be a big success story as well. $16 million over the weekend, $656 million worldwide. Minions, of course, is still a big hit. Another $15 million. It's at $1.2 billion and counting. And number 6 is The Visit. This is the M. Night Shyamalan movie, and like most horror films, it fell hard in its second weekend, but it apparently only cost $5 million to make, and it grossed $12 million over the weekend. It's at just about $50 million worldwide, and people didn't hate it. So it's a, you know, congrats all around.
Okay.
At number 7 is one movie that we'll focus on a lot. This is the German comedy we talked about last week. It's called Darn You, Goethe, Part 2.
Yes.
We're not going to say the actual full title because it's naughty. It grossed $12 million over the weekend. It's at $40 million and counting. It's a massive success story, isn't it, in Germany? This was, we didn't have this info last week, but it turns out that the opening weekend of this sequel, this German comedy, was the biggest opening weekend of all time for a German film.
Yes, in Germany, obviously.
Yes.
Yes, duh.
Yes.
Now there was a bit
the
of
biggest
a...
opening all-time film Germany in South Africa.
Yes.
No, that would be a natural other place. No, it was in Germany.
And there was a big riot in Germany at, I think it was in Nuremberg. There was, I guess, one of the actors came out, Mbarak, I can't remember his first name, Elias Mbarak. And 3,000 people came, according to the police. And the policeman said...
What do you mean? It was a public appearance to promote the movie? What was going on?
Yeah, it was at a cinema, public appearance to promote the movie. And the police said, more than 3,000 people came, mostly young girls. The cinema operator was unable to cope with the situation, then called the police for help. And so they had to cancel the screening.
It was a screening? Or he was showing up at the 7 p.m. screening of the movie?
Exactly.
And so many people show, aren't there just a limited number of tickets? I don't understand.
Yeah, but they were just showing up to see him.
Oh, they were just outside on the street?
Yeah.
And they got out of control?
Yes.
Okay, so it's a big popular film.
That's pretty much what I'm trying to say. I guess I can't say anything right, even when I'm not trying to make a joke.
And number 8 is Inside Out, another $10 million. Another 9, here's a fun film. It's called The Throne. It's a South Korean drama. It's set in the 1700s, I think. It grossed $10 million on its opening weekend, so a good solid start. We don't know the budget, but a good solid start. It's a period film, of course, and it's about true events in history. A crown prince who was not a nice kid. He was perhaps mentally unstable. He would occasionally kill people and rape people. And eventually the king had to have him killed. And he couldn't kill him for legal reasons, but he could order him to climb into a chest filled with rice on a hot summer day. And after 8 days, he suffered and suffocated and died. So that's the charming story that they're telling in this movie. I'm sure it'll be a big hit overseas. But it's a very famous tale. People debate whether the crown prince was actually crazy and doing all this bad stuff or whether he was set up. It's not clear. The historical record seems to show no. Yeah, he was kind of a really bad, nutty guy, but it's still a point of controversy. I don't know what this movie says about it, but, you know, it'd be fun to find out. If you saw The Throne, let us know.
So between Whitey Bulger and The Throne, you got main characters who, you know, not so nice. They're not so nice.
Not so nice. And I think that's it about it. We'll just finish off the top 10. The Perfect Guy made another $10 million over the weekend. It's at $41 million and counting. It started to open up modestly overseas, just like Straight Outta Compton, which is down at number 13. That's made almost $30 million overseas. So, you know, good commercial films, you should open up everywhere in the world because there's money to be made.
Well, which is exactly why Warner Brothers is moving so swiftly into China.
Swiftly?
Well, I mean, aren't they joining some capital group, China Media Capital, on Chinese language tentpole movies?
Yeah, we talked about this a few weeks ago. We said this was going to happen. Now it's officially happening that they're making a co-production deal. They got a new company. It's based in Hong Kong, and they'll have offices in Beijing and Los Angeles, and their first movie could come out as early as 2016. It doesn't solve all your problems because as far as, you know, what money you can take in or take out of the country, but there's money to be made. It's going to be the biggest movie market in the world, and they want to be there.
Well, and you can make a lot of money there. You just can't access it.
That's right. And I wish that, well, some of it you can get out, right?
I suppose, about 25%.
So they want to be in Beijing, and I would have loved to have been in Toronto and Telluride, you know, attending the film festivals, but I didn't get to do that. Luckily, Ann Thompson did.
You're right. Ann Thompson was at all of those film festivals. We're talking Telluride, Toronto. She was at so many festivals. If you're not following Ann on Twitter, and we will place links to her, all of her social media accounts and all of her work in our show notes. But if you're not following what Anne is doing, especially in the fall and leading into award season, you are really missing out. But just trying to follow her is tiring. So I was a little concerned when after Telluride in Toronto, I thought, do I reach out to her and ask if she can join us afterwards? Because, boy, I'd be tired. I'm tired just reading it. So, Anne, thank you so much for joining us.
You know, I have fun. I do. I mean, I get to go to all these fun parties and dinners and meet people. I mean, I enjoy it. I mean, being, if you look at, I did a little sort of Facebook travelogue thing and, you know, just looking at it, I think it looks like I'm enjoying myself. It's not, I still have a lot of stories to put up. I mean, there are people who kill themselves putting up things immediately. Sometimes I don't have time to do that, you know?
Well, and quite honestly, I thought, and we should point out that Anne is the editor at large at IndieWire. And one of the stories that you maybe kind of waited to put out was one of the better pieces coming out of Toronto, I thought, as a way of wrapping up. It was titled In Defense of the Conventional Movie, From Spotlight, which was the name of a movie, so from Spotlight to The Man Who Knew Infinity, both of those being movies. And you're basically saying, yeah, there are some Hollywood-type movies at Toronto. And you know what? That's okay.
I agree with that. And I did come up with the headline for on deck for that, but it was written by Meredith Brody, one of my writers.
Really? I thought yeah. I could have sworn.
She came up to me and said, you know, I want to write about all these movies that are like normal, old fashioned, you know, movies. And I said, in defense of a conventional movie. So that was written by Meredith Brody.
Yeah. Your picture is there.
You know what I should do is get a picture of her and stick it in there. I see how people could be confused. I should do that.
Yeah, because it's like the Wall Street Journal having a photo of the writer, and then it's actually not that writer. It's you're right. It is Meredith Brody. So I should have. I can't get anything right today, Michael. Have you noticed?
No, you're doing just fine, Sperling. Well, and you know that brings us. You do all these festivals. They're such a blur, and I have the same question every year. How was this year different from other years? Or what stuck out for you? Was there anything different going on the whole circuit, or at Toronto or Telluride in particular? Of course, Telluride. There's been a change in. And people at the top, Gary Meyer's not there anymore, right?
Yes, and I was very touched there at the very last screening that I went to, a movie called Viva, which is excellent. It's actually the Irish submission for the Oscars, even though it's a Spanish language movie shot in Havana, Cuba.
Really?
Yeah, by an Irish director and funded by Ireland. But it's a wonderful movie, but there was some... cry of thank yous to Gary Meyer at this screening, and I was very happy to hear that. He was a very popular and beloved figure, and very involved not only in putting the program together as a co-director for many years with Julie Hunsinger and Tom Luddy, but he was also very much involved in the classics programming there. And I will say that in his absence, there has been a slight tip in the direction of more mainstream Oscar movies. Again, I'm not decrying those, but one of the things that, Telluride has sort of gained status over the recent years by introducing so many of them. It's such a well-curated, well-run festival. But I think Gary was always fighting for the underdog, for the smaller films. And that balance that exists at Telluride is very important.
Yeah, I mean, I think he programmed Tulpan, if I'm not mistaken, which was this film that was shot and made on the steps of, I want to say, Afghanistan. It was, it was in a yurt. It was shot in a yurt. and it was just the strangest and yet most engaging film. And it was only at a festival like Telluride, or in Cannes before that, where you would see a film like that. And he was a big champion of that film.
That was a Kazakhstan.
Kazakhstan. I knew it was one of the stands.
So you thought perhaps Telluride was a little bit more mainstream this year. And of course, they were getting offered more big movies, because when you have success, that's part of why it may be happening.
Exactly. But they need, clearly Julie Hunsinger is the heir apparent. Tom Luddy is still going strong. He's fabulous, but he's leaning on her. You can tell that she's running the show. And she's a player, she's a power player with perhaps less arcane taste. Than Luddy and Meyer would have.
Well, and last year there was a big kind of kerfuffle between Toronto and Telluride, where Toronto said, listen, if you premiere your film at Telluride, which notoriously kind of doesn't announce its slate until a couple of days before the festival, Telluride is held in a very small ski town, mountainous town in Colorado. It's hard to get to. It happens over Labor Day weekend, the first weekend in September. And they announced the program.
Toronto wanted exclusivity. They said, if you show your movie at Telluride, we'll show your movie, but on the second week at 4 a.m.
Yeah, and so basically they showed their hand. They were really upset about 12 Years a Slave, which was supposedly a world premiere at Toronto. And so there was a correction. And basically what's happened now is that they've pulled back Toronto and Telluride and Venice. They're all playing in the same sandbox, and they're being transparent, and they're keeping no secrets, no surprises. And it all worked out fine. I mean, Toronto had a lot of the same. We talked about this last year. I mean, there's a natural sort of building of momentum that occurs from Venice to Telluride to Toronto, or from Cannes to Venice, from Telluride to New York. I mean, these festivals enhance and build on each other. And so something like Carol went from Cannes to Telluride and will go to New York, or something like Steve Jobs actually debuted in Telluride and goes to New York. And then something like Room did very well. So I'm coming from the outside a bit. A24's drama, which ended up winning the audience award in Toronto.
That's
so
a little surprising.
That was a real 1-2 punch.
And that's directed by Lenny Abramson and stars Brie Larson. What is Room about?
Room is based on a book by Emma Donoghue, which some people have read. I have not. Which involves a woman who's imprisoned. It basically in a single room with her, and she's been kidnapped, and this man who has kidnapped her and has basically rapes her every night, she has a child in this room, and she actually tries really hard to raise this child and take care and protect the child, and various rules have been established for the world view of the child that she's imposed, and eventually they figure out that they better escape. She's pretty depressed and trying really hard, but she, so then the first half is basically in the room, and the second half is what happens when they escape. It's a prison escape movie.
Yeah. Well,
it's sort of akin to Old Boy in a way, the Korean film that Spike Lee recreated, but it's less of an action film and more of a sort of a, is it more of a fable or more of a allegory, or what's your feeling for the movie?
It's very realistic. It's actually a realistic, naturalistic drama. It's very intense. It's more like a, as I said, it's more like an escape from Alcatraz. It's like a prison. It's got a thrilling component because she's in real danger. They are in real danger. There's a, they are not safe.
Well,
you know?
Another film that seemed to get a lot of press was The Danish Girl. And I think that's maybe because of Tom Hooper, who directed The King's Speech, and Eddie Redmayne, who, of course, won the Academy Award for Best Actor last year for playing Stephen Hawking in a film. What did you think of the film if you saw it?
Danish Girl, which was introduced in Venice, played Toronto, and it played very well. It got very good reactions. The reviews are good, but it's not unanimous. It's not one of those things where every single person agrees. I think what they do agree is that the actors did very well with this. You know, Eddie Redmayne, who won the Oscar last year, is actually playing a transgender, and this is a period piece. This is a pioneer and one of the first women to seek a sex change operation when it was very dangerous, and so he does that and beautifully, and Alicia Vikander, who has had an amazing year with Ex Machina and the movie Testament of Youth, she's coming along very well, and she's great in this too as his wife, who's a painter and who is trying to figure out how to be married to this guy who's going through an amazing change. So but it's not for everyone. You know, one guy sitting next to me was crying his eyes out, and someone, you know, other people are completely unmoved.
So stepping back, if you felt like Telluride became perhaps a little bit more commercial, what was your overview of Toronto?
Toronto is consistent. They run this very, very strong festival. It has a big acquisitions component. So you had Michael Moore's movie, Where to Invade Next, on opening night, you know, looking for a home, you know, and I enjoyed the movie. It's very strong and very much Michael Moore with a lot of different causes, political points of view, aiming at the audience in an entertaining, light way, engaging way. But there was also Janice, which was for sale, which is Amy Berg's latest movie about Janis Joplin, which played well. There were the other new movie included Maggie's Plan, which is Rebecca Miller's comedy, romantic comedy triangle with Ethan Hawke and Greta Gerwig and Julianne Moore with an accent of some European origin, which we were all arguing about. Is it Dutch? Is it German? Is it Scandinavian? Anyway, she is brilliant in this, and it's a great entertaining movie. Somebody's going to pick that up for a lot of money, I think. Ethan Hawke had a good festival because he's also gotten good reviews for his Chet Baker documentary.
That's a fictional
feature.
Film, isn't it?
Yeah, picture. It's fictional called, feature.
It's called Born to be Blue.
Born to be Blue.
Now
he has a novel, a fable written for his children called About a Knight and the Ethics of a Knight. He has the film he directed, the documentary about the great music teacher, and he's got two new movies. He's having a good year.
A very good year.
And Jay Roach, director Jay Roach, was there with Bryan Cranston, actor Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad. He had a film called Trumbo. Was this a film you saw?
Yeah, I liked Trumbo very much. One criticism of it, which is valid, is that it's sort of like a very well-made HBO movie, which Jay Roach knows how to do, obviously. But
is that a criticism?
It is for a feature film. I mean, it's very well made. It's very well written and directed and acted. And I learned things that I did not know about The Blacklist and about Edward G. Robinson. Michael Stuhlbarg had a very good festival season because he's playing a very good supporting part in Steve Jobs, which I loved. And he's playing a very good supporting part as Edward G. Robinson in this film, in Trumbo, a very moving role. And Bryan Cranston is terrific as Trumbo. He's a hero. He's a real hero, a bona fide hero. And you have various actors playing real people, you know, like John Wayne and Kirk Douglas and Helen Mirren is very delicious as Hedda Hopper, who is more powerful in a political way than I realized. She was really, I did not realize how strong her role was in the whole Blacklist. I knew about McCarthy and the people in Washington more than I knew about Hedda Hopper.
Well, now movies like The Martian, this is a Ridley Scott film. Okay, and it's Matt Damon starring as why am I blaming?
An astronaut Thank stuck
you. On
Mars.
He's an astronaut, and he's stranded on Mars, and this movie was probably the great breakout for Toronto because it could have been just another studio launch of a commercial release, a category I would apply to something like Black Mass, for example. But this is actually probably the best received critically acclaimed movie of the festival. It was a real breakout for a world premiere.
Well, what are the films that you think audiences will be hearing about not only throughout the rest of this year, but maybe into next year as award season goes on, both the ones we may know of and maybe a few that we may be learning about for the first time?
Well, The Martian may be, you know, in the awards conversation, but it may not. I mean, we'll see how it plays. I think Ridley Scott comeback story, Matt Damon in one of his best roles in years, and Drew Goddard's screenplay, very, very well adapted from the best-selling novel. I just think it celebrates American ingenuity in a way that both audiences and Academy voters may actually recognize, but
it's more like Apollo 13, isn't it? Than say
it's
Gravity.
Very close. That's a very good comparison. So then we get to something like 45 Years, which debuted in Berlin and has moved on from there, and it played well in Telluride. Small movie with by a very good writer director named Andrew Hay. I mean, Sundance Selects is handling this, and it has Charlotte Rampling and Tom Courtenay as a married couple who've been about to celebrate their 45th wedding anniversary when a huge monkey wrench in the form of a revealed secret, a woman from this man's past who was buried in the ice, had an accident when they were hiking and has been unearthed. And so this throws him for a complete loop, and his wife has to deal with it. And, you know, it's not easy. So that played very, very well. And I think there are a lot of performances from older actresses this year. You've got Helen Mirren from Women in Gold, which was back in the spring. And then you have also the Lily Tomlin performance in Grandma. You know, we'll see if that is more than a Golden Globe thing. But I think you also have Maggie Smith in Lady in the Van, which was shown in Toronto, which is she played the role on the West End 16 years ago in this hit play by Alan Bennett. And now she's back and she's amazing in this. It's directed by Nicholas Heitner. It's very good. Sony has it. So we'll see.
Yeah, I guess that's one of the big things that always comes out of Toronto. And even, well, not Telluride so much, but Toronto is all of the acquisitions. And there were some big ones this year. I mean, some films going for $10 million. I want to say that was Mr. Right. I could be wrong about that. But I know that Paramount picked up Annalisa, which is Charlie Kaufman's next.
Yeah, Annalisa will be in the conversation because it's Charlie Kaufman and a guy named Duke Johnson, and it's beautifully written. It's incredibly R-rated, and that's very clear at the beginning. And it's these beautiful felt, very naturalistic puppets, so it's not super stylized at all. And the idea is that this older guy is really depressed and kind of getting worried about his future. He's not happy, and he's visiting a convention, and he's going to give a speech, and he meets a woman, and right from the beginning they're using curse words, and he picks up this woman and has sex with her in his hotel room, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, and it's very graphic. It's very sexy, and it's felt puppets are going at it. You see little penises and, you know, breasts and all the, you know, pubic hair. You see everything, and it's somehow it really works. It's fine. It works.
Well, on that note, I guess we should maybe move from Oscar talk, which, no pun intended, of course, you do a podcast about during awards season, and you actually do a podcast now. I shouldn't say it's just during awards season. It's every week, really. But you also kind of follow the Emmys a bit.
Well, I watched it last night. I have a great TV columnist named Matt Brennan who covers the television for us. But I watched the Emmys last night, and I went to the HBO Emmys party, and I was delighted to see women, gay women, women of color,
women directors,
and incredible diversity in the winners. It was wonderful. And thank God John Hamm won as well.
Well, talk about a good party to go to. HBO just cleaned up last night.
It was incredible. It was the most they've ever won. 43, if you include all the creative arts Emmys, 14 for the night. But it was an amazing, amazing run for them, with Olive Kittredge and Game of Thrones winning drama over Mad Men. And the other show was Veep, which was great. So I'm a fan of all these shows. I'm delighted that they did so well. And Viola Davis did great as well. She became the first African-American woman to win for Best Actress in a drama.
And what do you think this means? I mean, because the big talk before the Emmys was, would Amazon and would Netflix show up and kind of start sweeping some of these awards away, and the focus turn toward kind of a different content provider, streaming instead of premium cable. That didn't really happen.
No, HBO clearly delivered. If you think about it, A Game of Thrones, I think one of the reasons why it won, besides the fact that it's finally more popular than Mad Men, you know, it's just way more numbers.
Mad Men was never popular. Game of Thrones is 10 times popular. There's a thousand shows more popular than Mad Men.
Yeah. 8 million a week for Game of Thrones versus 3.3 million for the last episode of Mad Men.
No, about 16 to 20 million a week for Game of Thrones. It's not even close.
I got that from the New York Times.
That's
million.
Wrong. They're talking about something about an overnight. When you look at how many episodes are watched, Game of Thrones and Walking Dead and all that are 20 million plus a week. It's not even close. Mad Men is like a couple
then
million.
It must be a single episode figure.
Yes.
For the one episode a week.
No, it's just a single one night viewing overnight figure. They're not looking at how many people actually watch the episode. When you add it all up, Game of Thrones is at 16 to 20 million people an episode.
Okay. So anyway, but it also shows what a big scale series can do in terms of challenging Hollywood and the studios. It's a stunningly mounted and executed show on every level, and I'm delighted that they won.
Well, and you know, speaking of campaigns and scale, or I should say scale, and then moving on to campaigns, I noticed this year, and as somebody who covers awards season yourself, did you notice this year how much campaigning there was going on for the Emmys? And I know it's happened in years past, but this year really seemed to be somewhat fierce.
There were a lot of categories that were contested very intensely. But I highly doubt, for example, that campaigning had any impact. I mean, you guys know television better than I do. For example, on Olive Kittredge, which aired like a year ago and almost, it seems. And you know, Frances McDormand is not someone who goes out and tub thumps. But it didn't seem to have that much impact on that one winning as many as it did.
Well, and I don't think necessarily that the Emmys necessarily, I mean, look, you had The Daily Show winning. Winning an Emmy for that show is not going to help it in any way, shape, or form.
That was about sentiment. And it was about the impact that Jon Stewart had on the entire universe of political conversations. You know, he really changed the way people talk about politics in late night, and he was beloved. I mean, whereas someone like Colbert, who's won in the past, is moving on to a new show.
Yeah, and I guess as much as we had first with John Hamm and Jeffrey Tambor, seven nominations, first win, he won for Transparent, which is an Amazon Prime streaming show. Viola Davis, who was the first person of color to win a lead drama, gave a great speech. Inside Amy Schumer winning that for a first. There were also Julia Louis-Dreyfus won for Veep again, Allison Janney won for Mom again, Peter Dinklage won for Game of Thrones again, Uzo Aduba won for Orange is the New Black again. So there
in
were
in a different category.
In a different category. So actually the first is, well, no, not the first. It's the second time somebody has won for the same role in both comedy and drama, which I thought was kind of, you know, I think everybody finds that interesting.
But it's interesting that Lisa Cholodenko and Jill Soloway, who were both out as gay women, also won Best Directing for their respective shows, which was cool.
Well, and your podcast is called Screen Talk. I have noticed you really, it's really big screen talk. It's never, it really doesn't go into television as much.
No, because I don't think Eric tracks it as much as I do. And we also have a television podcast on its own merits that it's done by two of our writers in television. So that's where that content is.
Certainly, it's always great to speak with you after Telluride in Toronto, and now this year the Emmys as well. Because you know, why shouldn't you have one more thing to cover after 2 or 3 weeks of that kind of travel. But so thank you very much for taking the time to join us. Of course, Anne's work can always be found on IndieWire, on the Thompson on Hollywood blog, and you should be following her on Twitter if you are not, especially during awards season. And definitely listen to Screen Talk, which is her podcast, and you can find it on iTunes and wherever podcasts can be downloaded.
Thank you, Sperling, my roommate from Cannes.
Yes. Thank you.
And thank you, Michael. It was
maybe
fun,
next
always.
Year.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Well, it was great of Anne to talk to us. Her comment about the ratings for television is one of my big bugaboos because it's reported so poorly. Very often, all they talk about is the overnight rating. She said she saw in the New York Times that Game of Thrones has 6 million. No. Last season, Game of Thrones averaged 18.2 million viewers for every episode. I mean, it's exponentially bigger than what they report in the overnight sometimes. And that's crazily misleading. Mad Men, in comparison, has never been a hit, never been a commercial hit. It's made money for them, perhaps, because of the demos. But Mad Men has never averaged more than 2 million viewers an episode.
Well, and that's a pet peeve, as you know, of the heads of HBO, Michael Lombardo, who doesn't want the overnights to be what is publicized, and he has that beef as well. But just going back to Mad Men for a second, you mentioned that it was never very successful. It might have been successful financially for AMC, but it was never a huge audience success. But now AMC is owned by the same folks who own Cablevision, which is an internet service provider and a cable operator in your neck of the woods, Michael, in New York. Now, I know you have Time Warner Cable.
Time Warner Cable has the city, doesn't they?
Yes, they have the city out in the suburbs. There's some Cablevision. And so it's a, you know, fairly, I think there's like 3 or 4 million subscribers. And last week, a French-Israeli company named Altice came in to buy Cablevision for $10 billion. And the deal values Cablevision at $17.7 billion. It's being financed with debt and equity. And Cablevision is a long... What's interesting about this is the Dolan family has owned Cablevision since 1973. And they built this company up on Long Island, starting in Long Island in New York, over decades. And they are finally selling their company. And it was kind of an emotional moment in doing so. But it's also kind of one of those moments where are they getting out before cable operators begin to see a decline in revenue. And there's also some talk in this acquisition about the person who heads Altice, who is French-Israeli, who kind of is, he's a personality, to say the least.
That's right. He said, look at all the people at this company making so much money. You guys get paid too much money.
Yeah.
He says, quote, I don't like to pay salaries. I pay as little as I can. So if you're an executive at Cablevision, I'd start looking for another job right away.
Right.
He said more than 300 Cablevision execs earn $300,000 a year or more. And they're like, sounds a little bit much to us.
Right.
So they think there's a lot of fat that they can cut away. But yeah, who cares? We're consumers. More consolidation in the cable business, it doesn't help us.
No, not at all. And in fact, part of the reason that Altice is looking overseas rather than in Europe is because they kept buying up all of their European competitors in different parts of the in different markets, and the EU in no uncertain terms said, you know what, we're thinking all of this consolidation isn't so good necessarily, so maybe we're not going to approve any more mergers. So you know, all of a sudden we have the head of and founder of Altice, Patrick Drahi, saying, okay, I'm going to go to the US. And that's right. Exactly, so what he's doing. And it's
so for consumers, it's a big whoop.
Well, I would say it could be a big deal if their rates go up. But I do know one thing, no matter whether their rates go up or whether their rates go down, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, you know, how could this not be our first story? CNN loves elections, right? 23 million people turned in or tuned in to watch the new sitcom 10 Guys and a Girl, also known as the Republican primary debates. Donald Trump is not the sole reason that everybody tuned in, even though he's huge. He hasn't been drawing this many viewers to his reality shows in a long time, and Arnold Schwarzenegger is probably kicking himself for making the mistake of being born outside the U.S. It's apparently a much bigger deal to be president than getting a TV show like Celebrity Apprentice. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It just shows an extraordinary level of interest in the election. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, we've seen debates that have rated this high, but this was generations ago. And for today, what I can't wait to see is the Democrat debates. How many people are going to watch that?
Well, you know, and they want to start
your candidates. There's not the colorful personality like Donald Trump. You've got, you know, three people at the moment, and the DNC, which is of course sees Hillary Clinton as the front runner, doesn't want to have debates. They've scheduled fewer debates than they've had in a long time, and they say, look, we had too many debates in the past, which is arguable. But six people feel like, and they're taking so long to start up. People feel like, hey, why are you letting the Republicans get all the attention?
Well, and some say, yeah, you're letting them get all the attention. It's not necessarily good attention.
No, that's true.
So it's like, maybe you should just kind of, you know, give them enough rope to hang themselves kind of attention.
Right. Well, that's certainly what Hillary Clinton is doing. She's keeping her powder dry. But as far as the networks are concerned, the more debates, the better.
Wow, keeping her powder dry. You know, today with, you know, I can't remember anything today for some reason. I don't think I could have come up with that. I just couldn't. But I do know, bam, pow, bat. That's the sound, by the way, Michael, if you're not familiar with it, of Batman fighting crime. And it's also the sound of one of the key figures in comic books getting his due. Bill Finger is one of those artists overshadowed by their more visible peers in the comic book world. But fans know Finger was hugely important to shaping Batman, just as Bob Kane was, and Kane has previously acknowledged that Finger was important. Now DC is also acknowledging that. Finger, who also co-created Green Lantern and other characters, will be credited in film and TV projects based on his creations, including TV's Gotham and the upcoming film Batman vs. Superman. Big deal or big whoop?
At the moment, it's a big whoop. It's nice for the family, it's nice for history, but what matters is the money.
Yes.
He died in 1974. And there was a recent reissue of the first comic book that Batman appeared in. He got credit from that. So DC was already starting this business of acknowledging his importance to Batman. His family was involved in this statement of support, of showing, you know, giving him credit where credit is due. But what they didn't mention is money, because there's a lot of money on play here. And is there a deal made? Have they agreed to pay the family something? You know, are they just doing this symbolically, or are they going to get a payday? And that's really what matters, because this is a huge commercial enterprise.
Now, the PGA is making a concerted push for more women in the film industry, specifically as producers and directors. They've released a quote-unquote toolkit to drive home the financial sense it makes to include women more prominently. So let's review now. Women are a majority of the population. That's part of what this toolkit kind of reveals. And on dates...
reveals?
Well, you know, kind of puts forth. On dates, women often are the drivers, not only on the dates, but as to what movies are going to be seen on the date. More women go to the movies than men. More women watch TV than men. Women control most spending decisions. And Amy Schumer is hilarious, right? So what are we waiting for, says the PGA? Big deal or big whoop?
It sounds like a big whoop. unless they can bring something in this toolkit that reveals something new. We realize all this. It's idiotic that more women aren't in charge, but I don't see how restating the obvious is going to change any minds. Unless they've done something unbelievably brilliant in this quote-unquote toolkit that will say, oh my God, you're right. I'm not won over by this initiative.
Well, and I think, yes, I agree with you. I think this is one of those initiatives where it's like, well, we had a whole bunch of people that said we needed to do something. We did it. Okay, there you go.
Yeah.
Speaking of women, by the way, Michael, network TV has featured one prominent executive for many years, but now Nina Tassler is stepping down from CBS after two decades to focus on directing and producing, and she's writing a book and some passion projects. True, CBS didn't have a great season last year, but Tassler is going out on her own terms and going out on top as one of TV's most respected and successful creatives. Her replacement, touted by Tassler herself? A dude. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. She's been a fixture in network TV for many years. CBS is just a genius at turning out the same kind of show over and over again and being very, very commercially successful at it. And she's done a great job. You know, everybody around there recognizes, and she's got a great relationship with talent. We'll have to see if she can do stuff as far as directing and producing other small projects down the road. Be interesting to see how that transfers over. But she certainly had a glittering career.
Indeed, she has. So has soul singer Sharon Jones, who, unfortunately, is back in chemotherapy. Her cancer has returned, as you kind of mentioned last week, Michael, I think.
Oh, did I?
Or maybe that was after we finished recording. I'm not sure. But after having fought cancer and finally gone back on the road in support of a new and terrific album, artist Sharon Jones got the bad news that her cancer is back. In fact, it was announced at the Toronto International Film Festival.
Where they had a documentary film about her, yeah.
Right. And you know, cancer coming back, never really a good sign, by the way, especially so soon after going into remission. Jones has a Christmas album called It's a Holiday Soul Party coming out October 30th. And now her fans know exactly what they should be wishing for. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's a real shame. I mean, she's a great singer. It's not a death sentence, but it's certainly not a good news medically. You're all rooting for her. She's been one of my favorite artists of the past decade. Just a string of great albums. I can't wait to hear the new one. And hopefully we'll be hearing from her for many years to come.
Well, speaking of hearing from people again, Craig Ferguson is back. Actually, the Peabody winning talk show host never really went away. He's got a game show in syndication that's in its second season. He toyed with the possibility of a talk show leading into prime time. An idea, by the way, never tried before. And one that TV stations, well, rejected, I guess is the best word. A sitcom didn't make it past the pilot stage, and now Ferguson has a chat show on the History Channel called Join or Die. It features Ferguson, along with experts and celebrities, taking on historical topics like who's the best founding father, what's the greatest invention, and so on. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right? Man gets job. However, I like Ferguson. He's a great talent, and it's interesting to see him exploring all these different areas and trying to figure out what's going to stick and what's going to work. Is this a good idea? I don't know. I mean, it depends on the mix of guests, right?
How good the
experts are, whether it seems glib and stupid or whether they're having substantial discussion. He's a smart guy. I'm going to tune in.
I agree. And I think he should be, you know, maybe serving alcohol on the show and they could go over history while being drunk. That sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
Okay, I was referring to drunk history.
Yes.
Okay, just checking. Now, if you do you have a Wi-Fi connection, Michael?
At the moment, I do. Yeah.
You do? Okay, but when you don't, how do you get your television?
You don't, right?
Well, no Wi-Fi connection, no problem. The cable channel Epix is now offering Genuine TV anywhere for its subscribers. They can download copies of movies and watch them offline even when there's no Wi-Fi or other internet connection available for streaming. Mobile viewing for when your kids are bored during a car trip? Yes, indeed. Big deal or big whoop?
It sounds like a big whoop to me. I mean, I know it's a step forward. I wonder how they did it. I mean, does it explode after, you know, 5 days? Or how does the download get erased, you know, the next time that you, you know, how do you not get to keep the movie forever? I'm not sure how it works, and I couldn't figure out where to find that out. I don't know if you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, these streaming apps, they have to check in every once in a while with the mothership. Right. They have to eventually connect back.
So if
to,
you ever connect again, that will get erased.
It will either get erased or they will check to see whether you're still a subscriber. And if you're not a subscriber, then all of a sudden the app becomes useless.
OK. But I mean, if it's downloaded, isn't it downloaded onto your computer?
These are probably mobile devices, and yes, it's downloaded, but it is encrypted, and there is digital rights management associated with it. So yes, you can strip the digital rights management if you know what you're doing, but it's not exactly easy.
So they've convinced everyone else, hey, you know, this is fine for the legal people. The people who are going to steal it have already stolen it, and the people who aren't going to steal it, it'll be taken care of.
Yeah, hey, they're paying for it now.
No, but I'm saying as far as getting free copies of stuff and handing it around, you know, guess what? People are already stealing the copies. And so this particular iteration of your movie is not going to be a big vulnerable threat point.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, the BBC is also going over the top. The venerable UK institution is launching an over-the-top service for the North American market in 2016. Access to BBC offerings for a small monthly fee anywhere in the world is the basic idea. Of course, the BBC owns BBC America, but that channel often doesn't always offer actual BBC offerings. See, offer actual BBC.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Okay. Though they do, by the way, BBC America, they do get Doctor Who. So now you can watch Downton Abbey without waiting. Wait, is that, you can do that? Wait, no, actually, no, not quite, actually. That show ends its run in the UK this year, and it's on ITV. But BBC will join their news websites and radio to the BBC offerings on tap to one and all, even the colonies. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop, right?
Yeah, it's just another OTT.
Because they tried this a few years ago with the iPlayer. They had this great player that everybody in the UK loved, and people around the world were clamoring to get it and getting friends episodes that they could get access to so they could use the iPlayer. And they tried to launch it in the US and it didn't work. I'm not sure why it didn't work. I'm not sure what happened that this failed, because BBC is a great brand name, but it didn't work. So now they're trying again. That's great. I love the BBC. We'll have to see if it works out. Is Doctor Who on BBC America or are they on Sci-Fi? I now forget.
I think they're on BBC America.
Okay, good.
Yes, so we were right about that. Finally, I'm right about something today. Finally. Theme parks are proving dependable money earners. We kind of all knew that for a while. Some feared theme parks would tank in a serious recession, but that hasn't proven the case. So Disney keeps adding to their portfolio, and now Universal, you know, Universal Studios, they are heading into, guess where, Michael?
Ni hao.
That's right, China. They've announced a Beijing theme park that will come to the country in 2019, because apparently they can just build this thing nonstop. How are they going to do that so soon? Ultimately, it will cover 1,000 acres and include 6 hotels, theme parks, water parks, and more, including such universal staples as Harry Potter, Transformers, Jurassic Park, and more. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, I guess, right? It's a big step into a new market. The first stage that's opening in 2019 is basically a hotel and quote-unquote entertainment. I don't know what that means, but I guess the big theme park stuff will come later.
They will
so
have,
that's how they claim they're opening up in 2019. It's going to happen in stages, and the first one is a big hotel.
They will have a hotel and a movie theater.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I think that what they really need to do is clone a dinosaur and then put it like in a pen.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I think I saw a movie about that once, and I had to leave early from that screening. But boy, it was a movie about a theme park with a dinosaur in it, and everybody seemed to be enjoying it. I shouldn't have gone down that road, right?
Nope.
Well, I guess then maybe let's talk about young adult author Cornelia Funke.
You're in a funk, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. Comedy funk. I guess maybe you could call her a kids author, Cornelia Funke. She is dumping her publisher in the U.S. One reason? A debate over whether she is writing for mainly 9 to 12-year-olds or 14 and up, as Funke insists she is. When her latest book came to be edited, both the U.S. and U.K. teams felt opening with a birth scene was too graphic for those 9-year-olds. Funke took a deep breath and decided to go it alone. She has created series hits like Inkheart and Mirror World and becomes one of the biggest authors in the world to go solo, at least in two of the biggest markets. The U.S. is first and the U.K. is likely to follow. Funke is creating apps and rewriting book one of Mirror World because she understands that universe better and will give it away for free as an ebook, and crafting a picture book specifically for indie bookstores, and on and on. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. She's a big worldwide name brand author. She's about the biggest one I can think of who is still a very active, ongoing author who's going to go solo in one of the biggest markets in the world. You know, she's in demand. This is not somebody small, and this is not somebody whose career is mostly over and they're just sort of reissuing stuff. No, this is and she's exploring all the creative options that you have, you know, like reissuing one of her books and doing a rewrite and just giving it away for free so that she can help promote that world and get people to read the rest of the books and the next one in the series. That's something a lot of publishers will be wary about, but she's happy to do because she owns the rights and she can do it. So who is your book for? It's very tricky in the children's book market. You know, middle grade, young adult, tweens. It's really hard to narrow cast your book and hit that sweet spot. And she's not worried about that. She said, look, this is fine. And if younger kids read it, they'll be fine. And if older kids read it, they'll love it. She knows what works for her books. They weren't on the same page as her. And I think this is just about the most significant author to go solo that I've seen so far.
Now, is she going to be one of those authors that winds up hiring a whole bunch of other writers that actually do the work? No.
I mean, that's very uncommon. There are. I mean, it's not uncommon, but there are series like, you know, Nancy Drew Hardy Boys and James Patterson. There are people who do that, especially when they get older or, you know, they get overwhelmed with work and, you know, they work with their kids or other authors. But that's not where everybody's going. That's not like the trend. That's always been happening where you have books written by groups of different people or you have best-selling authors today, you know, pair up with writers. That happens, but that's not the trend of the industry as such.
August Wilson is coming to HBO. Mainly,
he's going
to
win an Emmy.
I think so. The acclaimed late playwright delivered one of the towering works of theater with his American Century, a cycle of 10 plays that included one for each decade. Because you know what? If you're going to write one play, you may as well just write 10. Now these plays are coming to HBO. Denzel Washington will direct and star in Fences, the show he did on Broadway. And Washington will oversee filming of the other 9 plays as well as for the paid channel. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. He's going to be producing the other 9 works. That's how I should have phrased that. I love August Wilson. He's like the greatest American playwright of all time. Not of like the last 20 years, not the greatest black playwright. He is the greatest American playwright. You know, Tennessee Williams, Edward Albee.
Neil Simon.
Not Neil Simon. He's not even in the conversation. Eugene O'Neill.
Arthur Miller.
Arthur Miller is probably the closest. You know, they've all got 3 or 4 really stone cold classics. And then they got other plays that build on their legacy. August Wilson has like 6 or 7 or 8 Stone Cold classics. I really believe that. So I just love his work. I want to see it every chance I can. The more people that see them, the better. So I'm excited by the project. I can't wait to see it.
Stone Cold classics, keeping her powder dry. You're filled with them today. I'm filled with them too. They're just bad jokes is what I'm filled with.
Actually. All right. But that's it for Big Deal, Big Whoop, isn't it?
Yes, it is. In fact, it is time instead for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we're talking about a case, and it's a case that has lasted 8 years and will likely go to the U.S. Supreme Court. A judge has ruled that copyright owners must take into account the possibility of fair use before sending a takedown notice. How's that for a novel? Before you send the notice, make sure that, you know, it's not fair use. Michael, you and I know a lot about that.
That's right.
The case revolves around a 29-second video of a toddler dancing with Prince's song Let's Go Crazy playing in the background. We've all seen it. It went viral. Universal sent a takedown notice, sparking an online outcry that this was clearly fair use. Now the case is going to trial and been working its way through the court system for 8 years. The judge didn't rule that Universal should have known whether or not fair use applied in any particular instance, merely that it consider fair use before requesting a takedown notice. However, it also enjoined copyright owners to do more than pay mere lip service to the idea. The case is likely to be appealed, naturally.
And it hasn't even been, you know, decided yet. They're just in the pre-trial section. But no matter what happens, it's going to be appealed. I think this is hugely important. I mean, we've had takedown notices for including snippets of a trailer that we were given to use in YouTube. They're like, hey, here's our trailer. Please feel free to post it online. We take a 10 seconds of it, post it online, and they say, oh, take that down.
And the funny thing is they weren't even going with like an audio thumbprint where they said, oh, we know that this is copyrighted material because of the audio in it, because we stripped the audio out, and you and I were talking over the trailer. so that we could kind of say, oh, here's what this movie's about, and it's is it good, is it bad? This was when we were in Cannes a couple of years ago. And so we would kind of cut in between ourselves talking about the movie and the actual clips from the film. And because those clips of the film were there, they took a video thumbprint of it and said, oh, nope, that's copyrighted material, pull it down, just automatically pull it down.
That's right. The Electronic Frontier Foundation was working with the woman who was sued or had to take down notice and created this case. And Corinne McSherry, the foundation's legal director, said in a statement, today's ruling sends a strong message that copyright law does not authorize thoughtless censorship of lawful speech. You can't use this as an excuse to just make everybody shut up.
Right.
And of course, on the other side, the Recording Industry Association of America and the other groups that backed them, like the MPAA, they all said, hey, look, this is supposed to be what's it called? It's called affirmative defense.
That's
right. Meaning you can't use this. You can't force us to deal with this before you're sued. Like, we can sue you and you can go to trial and you can claim fair use as an affirmative defense, but you can't use this to handcuff us before anything has happened.
Right. You can't use it as a chilling effect, basically. And that's what
on them suing you, on them telling you to take it down.
Right.
Right. And the judge says, no, you're wrong. That fair use is unique. You can't just ignore fair use, and you can't just pay lip service to it. You have to actually believe that you've taken into consideration going, no, yeah, I don't think this is fair use. You have to look at this mother's 29-second clip of her baby with a song playing dimly in the background and say, that's fair use or that's not fair use. You can't just send out the notice.
Right. And, you know, I think pendulum swing, right? And so the pendulum swung in the late 1990s and the early 2000s with, you know, basically all the piracy and all of the copyright
sampling
infringement.
And everything, yeah.
And so it got out of control. So the pendulum swings back the other way, where basically anything and everything, fair use or not, that may or may not infringe on copyright, everything gets the takedown notice. And there is a happy medium, and I think what the judge is saying is, hey, guys, find the happy medium. Part of finding that happy medium is, hey, record companies, before you start sending out letters and suing everybody, at least look at this stuff and
see.
But
that's impossible, isn't it? To take this out of the record company, they are doing just automated take it down, take it down, take it down, because they cannot conceivably sit down and have somebody examine every use of a snippet of music online. There's 10 gazillion videos being posted every day to YouTube. There is no way for them to legally sit there and have somebody, the mere fact of having to look at it and have a person make a decision about it makes it ipso facto impossible.
Yes. And if you want to know why it's impossible to go through all these videos, as of the end
There's
of last year.
There's too many of them?
Well, as of the end of last year, it was estimated by YouTube that during every minute of the day, there are 300 hours of footage uploaded per minute to YouTube. So there's no way to go through it all. So it has to be done through algorithms and through automated processes.
Well, it has to be done. Right? You can't have a human being, but to sift that down and have human beings decide on the most egregious ones is really difficult, isn't it? They need to filter a lot more finely. They can't just send out takedown notices. You got a wedding and you got people dancing to their first dance at their wedding and there's a song playing. So what? Right?
Yeah. And that's why the estate of Etta James has stopped suing, you know, wedding couples for playing At Last during their first dance.
Oh, really?
I'm kidding. It's like the most common played song for the first dance.
Okay. All right.
Wow. I am just like, you know what? I can't win for losing today.
So it's a big issue, fair use. And not only has the pendulum swung back a little bit, blah, it's like, no, 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 it's all out of whack still. Copyright is out of whack. Fair use is out of whack. Their work should not be held in chains for 75 years after an author's death. There should be a lot more public domain stuff a lot quicker. And I love artists and I want people to profit. I want them to make lots of money when they create something special and unique. That's great. But as far as what matters for the country and the culture and the world, this stuff should not be under lock and key for 100 years.
Are you trying to say that copyright might be broken?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Well,
there's a great book called, it's just like a New South Wales book that I came across online. It's called Copy Fight, which I thought was a great play on copyright.
You emailed that to me and I meant to respond, yeah, I agree with you. That is a great title.
Yeah, it's not a book I recommend. It looks like it's a pretty obscure academic work, but nonetheless, very clever title.
So you wouldn't be recommending it, say, on off the top of my head, Book Filter.
That's right.
Okay. Well, would you recommend that people see the work of Jack Larson?
Well, there's not a lot to see, Jack. I mean, he's a writer and he's a great talent. You know, he's an interesting guy.
A writer or an actor?
He's a writer. He's an actor. He's a producer. His claim to fame is playing Jimmy Olsen on the TV series Superman. That is what he will be always known for. He died recently at 87. But, you know, as a kid, he was a state champ in bowling. He almost went pro. And that made him appear in an old early movie clip. But that's not where his acting bug began. He went to junior college. They're like, hey, you're talented. You should write some skits and stuff. And somehow some talent scout saw him on stage and was like, that kid's a star. And suddenly he was out in Hollywood making a movie with Rock Hudson. And somehow Superman fell into his lap. Like so many actors before, he said, oh, this will never fly. I'll just do this show and then it'll disappear and I can go on with what I really want to do. And of course, it became a massive hit. He couldn't walk out the door without getting harassed. And, you know, that was it. So he went on and started doing writing and producing. He fell in love with director James Bridges. They were an openly gay couple for decades, long before most people were. They were sort of openly closeted in Hollywood. Everybody knew them. Everybody knew they were together. James Bridges, of course, directed Urban Cowboy, The China Syndrome, and they worked together on Mike's Murder and Bright Lights, Big City and some other stuff. And so now Jack Larson has died at 87. James Bridges died, unfortunately, like 20 years ago. But they were together for decades, and now kind of a fun, interesting career comes to an end.
I can't believe, after practicing my Donald Trump impression and my Arnold Schwarzenegger impression and really just falling flat on my face with him this week, that you can just casually make a joke that that Superman landed in his lap and that he said, oh, this show will never fly.
Sorry about that. Two other people died this week that we're going to mention. William Becker of Janus Films. This is somebody who has really been a curator and a tastemaker, and most people don't even realize it. Janus Films brought a lot of foreign films and independent films to America, and then they curated them and made them available to colleges and universities. Anybody who went to college in the 60s and 70s and 80s probably saw Janus Films, classic presentations of movies like Citizen Kane and other stuff. It was like you saw the movies that he did, and he created a library of classic movies, both domestic and foreign, international, that really created the standard for, you know, taste in film history and for what a lot of people consider the classics. You know, he's really been a really influential mover and shaker by distributing movies, by making them available on college campuses, by making them available on Laserdisc and VHS and DVD and Blu-ray. So William Becker has been a real big figure in movie history and helping people learn about all the great directors around the world and helping keep them prominent here in the U.S. and sort of, you know, put them in the canon of movies that we care about.
Well, and if you've ever heard of the Criterion Collection, that was William Becker. He founded that and got that off the ground. And then over the weekend, Jackie Collins, she passed away from breast cancer. She died from, I guess, she is the sister of Joan Collins, an author, Michael, as you know.
Absolutely.
More than 500 million copies of her books have sold. Her first book was in 1968 called The World is Full of Married Men. I think it was a book where she just complained the whole time, right?
No, it's about extramarital sex.
Oh, and okay.
Barbara Cartland, who is a famous UK romance novelist, she wrote Hearts and Flowers type romance novels where the heroine was always virginal and pure and good and at the end got married before she even did anything like hold hands. She said that this book, The World is Full of Married Men, was, quote, nasty, filthy, and disgusting, end quote. It was banned in Australia and South Africa. They said, we can't publish this book. And they're like, look at all this cursing. She's like, well, I'll get rid of the cursing. She got rid of the cursing. They still banned it. And she said, what's the matter? Don't you have married men there? But I mean, look at the world that we live in now. That was just 1968. I was alive then. That's like less than 50 years ago where this book was a scandal. Shocking. And now today, my goodness. She learned a lesson, though, because her second book was called The Stud.
Right. I love that. I love that her second book was, oh, yeah? Well, guess what? Now this guy's not going to be married. How about that?
Yeah. And, you know, it also is a, you know, get tested for cancer. You're a woman, get an update, get a thing, do whatever you need to do. Make sure you go get, you know, there's a thing about too much testing, not enough testing. You know your family history. You know what's smart and good to do. Talk to your doctor and, you know, get tested. Because when you look at like Sharon Jones getting cancer, you look at Jackie Collins, who probably had some of the best health care in the world, right? She's super wealthy. So she, I'm sure, had every possibility of getting taken care of and catching it as early as possible. And still, she dies of breast cancer. So it's really hard. And she was stalked by cancer her whole life. Her husband died of cancer in 1992. Then her fiance, she got after him. He died of cancer in 98 before they could even get married. And now she herself dies of cancer at 77. So very sad, but, you know, she lived life to the fullest right up to the end.
That's right. And her most successful novel, Hollywood Wives, sold more than 15 million copies.
Right. And she had 32 books. So I'm a little sketchy about how she got to 500 million copies worldwide. But that's the number that everyone keeps reporting. I think it's one of those numbers that get thrown out and everyone just keeps repeating it. So now it seems like fact. To me, it seems a little suspicious. I imagine it's probably maybe even half that. I don't know. But if the best book she ever did sold 15 million, I don't see how she gets to 500 million.
Well, I will say this. 500 million downloads of Showbiz Sandbox? No, that is not accurate. 15 million, however. 15 million? Very accurate. Very,
oh,
very accurate.
Very good. Yes. Very nice. Well, you know, when we've got enough episodes, we're up to episode, what, 296 next week?
That's right. And actually, you know, the reason that everybody can download those shows, and all the way back to episode number one, where I probably sounded just as illiterate and I can't even think of a good word today, you can download all of them at iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere that podcasts can be found or subscribed to or downloaded. That is where you can find our show. And please do rate and review the shows in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. Subscribe to the show. That also helps us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. We'll place links to all of Ann Thompson's work in the show notes and on our website. And I'd like to thank Ann Thompson of IndieWire for joining us. It's always great to speak with her after Toronto and Telluride. And this year, she was also able to join us for a little Emmy talk. Again, her podcast is Screen Talk. Our podcast is Showbiz Sandbox. Our website is showbizsandbox.com. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Our voicemail is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All that information, including ways to follow us, at Showbiz Sandbox is our Twitter handle. Search for us on Facebook and like our page. Showbiz Sandbox is our page. ShowbizSandbox.com is where you can find all that info. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting most of the time. What is it this week, Michael?
It's pleasedon'tfeedthesperling.com.
I have no idea what that even means, but if you know, please write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or, you know, head on over to Michael's site, michaelgiltz.com, for, and you know, it's where he aggregates all of his writing on the entertainment industry and elsewhere. He can also be found on the Huffington Post. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.